Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. That voice you just heard is Erin Ray. She's a singer out of Nashville who I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about. She signed a record deal with Single Lock Records, the label co-founded by John Paul White, formerly of the Civil Wars. Erin Ray's songs remind me of those Civil War songs. Her music is quiet and intimate, trying to make sense of conflicted feelings. Her new record, Putting On Airs, explores, among other things, her struggles with being open about her sexuality. We talk about a little bit of everything, literally from A to Z, in this case, Alabama to ZZ Top. Plus, at the end, a special treat. She performs a song that means a lot to her. Here's our conversation. Erin Ray, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so you're from Jackson, Tennessee, which is about halfway between Memphis and Nashville. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I was born in Memphis and raised in Jackson until age 11, and we moved to Nashville.
Okay, so did Jackson have, maybe you couldn't tell because you were 11, but did it feel like more of a Memphis place or more of a Nashville place? Was it kind of pulled one direction or the other?
No, I think Jackson's kind of its own little place.
Oh, really?
It does have the... it's its own place somehow. It's the home of rockabilly. Carl Perkins is from there, and so he kind of helped put it on the map. So Johnny Cash and folks came through there, going from Memphis to Nashville, I think. But yeah, I think it stands alone.
Okay, but you moved to Nashville when you were pretty young. So, and your mom and dad were musicians, right? Or are musicians?
Yeah, my dad worked at Martha White when we lived there in Jackson, and my mom worked for Blue Cross Blue Shield. But they played music around coffee houses and, you know, Davis Kid Bookstore, county fair kind of things. And I sang with them when I was real little and then got pretty shy for a while. And there's about a 12-year gap between when I got a little self-aware, you know, and started singing again later on. But yeah, they were where I get my music influence from, my dad especially.
So what kind of stuff would you be singing when you were up there, especially when you were a little kid?
Anything with, well, just kind of whatever, because by about 5 years old, I've been hearing him play this collection of songs that he has accrued over the years, songs by Doc Watson and Merle Haggard, Mississippi John Hurt, Kate Wolfe, Nancy Griffith.
That's a pretty good good education for a later in life songwriter, right?
Yeah, yeah. He got to start playing in rock bands. He had a band called the Slim Pickens Band from Missouri, and they back in the 70s, and him and his rough and tumble bunch would roll around the region and play pool halls and Marriotts and stuff.
and did he tell you stories about sort of the rock and roll life stories that made you want to do it, stories that made you not want to do it, or some of both?
Well, I think he probably spared me until my more recent years about the more explicit details of the rock and roll lifestyle. We grew up with him telling us amazing stories from his childhood, and he's got, I kind of want to record a bunch of stories that of his, but yeah, he's let some slip more recently now that I'm an adult, kind of get a little bit more behind the scenes of what was actually going on.
I remember something in all the kind of voluminous stuff I've read about you in the last couple of weeks about ZZ Top and meditation or something. Was that your dad?
Yeah. Yeah, my dad was, I believe the story is, he's got a colorful career past. And for a time, he hitchhiked from Memphis to Nevada and worked in casinos and hotel bars and stuff. And I guess one time, I think he might have to correct me later, but I think the story is he was hanging out at a hotel pool that he, I don't know if he was working there or what, but ZZ Top was there. ZZ was already, he was already sober, I think, at the time, and into meditation. And my dad was kind of getting tired of his party lifestyle. And this is in the 80s, I guess, early 80s. And he introduced him to transcendental meditation, basically. And which is
those noted transcendental meditation practitioners in ZZ Top,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yes.
That's amazing. And did it stick for your dad?
Oh, yeah. Well, he went on to, he studied with the Maharishi, like the Beatles Maharishi, in Switzerland for like 8 months or something. He went over and cooked at the school or monastery or whatever, and in exchange for getting to meet, he said he made him laugh one time that Maharishi arrived, and what it was protocol for everybody to line up and bow kind of and have your head down and palms together to pay respect. And they would bring him flowers and offer him flowers when he arrived off the airplane. He said he was up at the front, and he gave him a flower and bowed. And then he ran around once he got past. He ran around, got in line again, and gave him a flower again. And he said he did it a third time. And the third time he showed up, Maharishi just died laughing. But yeah, it's pretty crazy. He still meditates twice a day, like 20 minutes morning and evening throughout my whole life. It'd be like we'd be in the car on the way home from a family trip, and he'd be like, "All right, y'all be quiet. Daddy's got to meditate."
Wow. And did any of that stick with you?
Yeah, I mean, I am still I'm about fed up with how disorganized my days are, like how I think it's finally getting to be time where I think I had to just get frustrated enough with like not feeling kind of frantic, you know, and just like waking up and getting online immediately or something. I think, but that practice, it's my mom's Buddhist now and teaches meditation. So just, you know, having the awareness or the resources of that practice has been really valuable to me. And there's, you know, all kinds of apps and stuff now. So you can do it for 3 minutes if you want to, you know, just calm down for a second. And I'm not real disciplined with a practice by any means, but it is nice to know that it's there. And that's kind of how, you know, if I need to, and I felt the best when I'm maintaining, you know, 10 minutes in the morning before I start getting on Twitter and whatever, but
I've come to believe the most diabolical feature of the smartphone is the clock, because it made everybody basically throw away their alarm clocks and use the phone as your clock. And so the first thing you do in the morning is you pick up your phone, you know, you turn off the clock, and it's there, it's in your hand, and it's there while it's there, you know. And so I think if they remove the clock, that would solve a lot of the problems.
So, yes, I think so.
So now, as you were growing up and singing with your family and then not singing with your family for a while, obviously they were deeply interested in music. Did your folks ever tell you, "Wow, you've got a pretty voice, you should maybe try to sing, you should take lessons"? Did they push you in any way toward, you know, this life that you've ended up living?
Well, they were always super affirming, and my dad especially, well, both my parents, but like my mom is a writer among many things, and she helped me write my first little poems and stuff when I was little. And, you know, they kind of made a fuss over any creative stuff that we did. So they'd say, you know, they'd comment and like, "Oh, you sound so pretty. Are you singing in the shower?" I was like singing that Arms of an Angel song by Sarah McLachlan.
Oh, my God.
One time.
The one that's on all like the, 11. The animal rights commercials right there.
Yeah. That's the one.
Oh, man.
And I came out and my mom's like, "I thought you were listening to the radio." You know, it's like whether or not they were bullshitting me is like it proved helpful. And, you know, they never were like, "You have to do this." They only wanted us to do stuff we were interested in, which I think is a blessing. So I took lessons here and there, but nothing no strict regimented thing, and I think that kind of allowed me to find my way to it.
What other things were you interested in before music? I mean, as far as like doing it for a life, maybe.
Well, I tried, you know, growing up, I tried all different kinds of sports and stuff. I'd considered being a therapist. That's what my mom does for a living, and we've spent a lot of time. We went to family therapy growing up, like in my high school years, and then on after that. So that seemed like a natural to maybe consider. But when I turned 18, I got a guitar, and for my birthday / graduation, and yeah, I think I have considered going back to school. I thought about, in more recent years, I've thought it would be really cool to be a teacher, and that might be something I do later on. But yeah, teacher, therapist, or musician, I think. Those are my options.
Those are all pretty good. How long was it from that point, you know, when you turned 18 and you got the guitar, to when you started kind of playing out in public and that sort of thing?
It was a bizarrely quick turnaround because I met some kids on the stoop my one semester at Tennessee Tech in Cookeville, Tennessee, and they all were playing Bob Dylan and stuff. So I tried to learn how to play guitar to play along with them. But then I did an open mic in Nashville. My brother moved to town, my older half-brother. And I guess the first thing I did was at the first open mic I went to, I sang like an a cappella song. It was an old Doc Watson song. It's kind of
Which one do you remember?
Wild Bill Jones.
Sure.
And then I just kept going back and started trying to write my own songs from there. And basically it was like I wrote a song and then would turn around and play it. And then wrote a song, and then like the open mics were every Thursday. So I kind of just was on this little schedule of just wanting to participate, you know, with all my new friends there. And so it was kind of like a simultaneous thing, like learning to write songs and playing them at the same time.
Right. There's so many people who do those open mics or poetry readings or whatever it is, and 99% of them sort of fall away at some point. So what kept you going? Was it a sense that you were getting better at it? Was somebody, did somebody step in with some kind words? What kept you moving forward?
I think I've been super fortunate to have really positive feedback around me all the time from different people. So one of my mom's good friends, just by chance, she met a woman named Kathy Matea.
Oh yeah.
When we were growing up, and she kind of became like an aunt, her and her husband, aunt and uncle sort of figure to us. And so, when I got ready to, I was making the decision to stay back from college, she connected me to this incredible vocal coach and sweet woman named Phoebe Binkley. And she was about 73 when I met her, I think. And the thing was, is she, since we're kind of like spiritually, as a family, kind of spiritually all over the map, you know, just we went to different churches and stuff growing up. I feel like I don't know. I'm like a big universe person, you know what I mean? Like, oh, the universe is, it, you know, whatever. It just, and kind of paying attention to us, you know, kind of signals from a higher power to keep going or not, you know. And so getting connected with her was like the first one, you know. And then Phoebe really, I worked with her for about 5 years. And she just taught me so much about how to show up for things. She taught me about psychosomatics is what she called them. And where you kind of like snap, you just kind of snap, you know, like, okay. She's like, do something physical to get yourself in gear, basically. Like if you need a little pick-me-up and you're not having a good day, but you got to show up for this thing that is important to you or your career, you know, it's like, just like pop, you know, slap yourself on the knee or snap or something, you know, and be like, all right, you know, game face kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but it just really felt magical. She had this wall of women that she had worked with over the years. And it felt to me like I was connected to a larger tradition and, you know, like a community of musicians for several generations. You know, it kind of, I was like, okay, cool. I feel like part of this thing now.
I know at some point you know, you talked about the wall of women that Phoebe had there. I know at some point you connected with a women's songwriting group, right?
Yeah.
A bunch of different. Sorry. Now, is that still an active thing, or was that something that was just there while you were there?
Well, it's really just a. We've done it 3 times, I think, at different people's houses, like kind of in the slower seasons.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the first one we did, it was at Margot's house, and this was a few years ago.
And that's Margot Price, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were all, it was really sweet, because it was just like, everyone invite any of the girls that you know that you want to work with, and or not that you want to work with, but just that you know are musicians that you are friends with, you know, and we can all just hang out, eat snacks, have wine, and swap songs. And, or maybe that was the second one. The first one was at Becca Mancari's house. And she's another great musician from Nashville. But anyway, same principle. And it was just the sweetest, like, most heartwarming thing. Like, Lily Mae and her sisters were there. Brittany Howard from the Shakes. Margot, me. So many women. I'm trying to think who else. Caroline Spence. But the list goes on, you know. It's just, and it's grown every time. Liz Cooper, Leah Blevins, Christina Murray, Kelsey Walden. It's just this, like, chill bump-inducing experience. We're all just, like, because we all are, you know, kind of disarmed a little bit just by the nature of that. We all are, you know, in our own lives working on propelling ourselves forward. And we all, like, love each other's music and stuff, but it's such a cool thing to kind of come in and just be, like, yeah, we're not trying to promote ourselves here. It's really, we're just want to hear each other and celebrate each other. And it's like, it makes me want to cry, you know?
Well, that's a good thing when you feel emotion about something, right?
Yeah.
Did you feel like there's a different vibe than when you've co-written with guys? I mean, was the feeling in the room more collegial or more anything in particular?
Yeah, I mean, it's cool. We've done... There's something really special about just that feminine energy all being gathered into one space and not a sense of competition being there and just the championing of each other. And I think, you know, in a lot of folks' interviews and stuff, you see that come up about Nashville. And I don't know, with guys, yeah, I love, there's as much as I love all our women in town, there's also a lot of incredible music being made by our man friends.
our man friends, yeah.
There's like, you know, who are just really good people. Charlie Whitten, Andrew Combs, Carl Anderson, a band called Harpooner, Ian Ferguson. It's the list, you know, it just goes on and on. And I always feel like I'm being annoying when I start listing people, but it's truly that everybody is so good.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I want to know, you know, obviously we're in this, you know, time in our country when guys who have done bad things to women are being, you know, exposed daily right and left. And I know in that room with a group of women, many of whom have been doing this for quite a while, I just wonder whether, did y'all share stories about that sort of thing, or have you heard stories?
We really didn't. I mean, of course, over, like, later today, I'm going to hang with a couple gals that are good friends, but also admire their music a lot. And that's just kind of the perk of getting to be, to have friends that are in the same line of work as you, is getting to trade stories. But in those events, it's more just like sweet and fun, and it doesn't get real talkative or anything, but it is nice. Me and Lily Hyatt, and we've kind of gotten to dish about different things or being just, I haven't experienced anything awful, but, you know, just little comments or things that you're like, you wouldn't say that if I was not a woman.
Right.
You know, you wouldn't introduce me as, I don't know, I talked about this in a previous interview, but basically someone introduced me on stage. They're like, well, let's see Erin Ray here. I hope her music is as pretty as she looks in that dress, you know, and it's kind of like an old-fashioned way. And that's the thing, too, is, like, I think it's just a shift in culture. That's things like that are just, like, not that long ago, that's what the norm was. And, my dad and I were talking about it on a long drive back to Nashville, and he was, like, we were listening to a podcast about it, I think, and he was, like, you know, us, he was born in 53. And he was like, you know, all of us guys, we just got it wrong. We didn't know. We really just thought that that was okay and what people wanted to hear, you know. And of course, like, I don't know, there's certain situations. I mean, not to, whatever. Like the other day at the airport, someone made a really, really funny comment to me. He pretended like he got his breath taken away. And I was like, it just made me laugh so much. He was like, oh my gosh. And he's like slapped himself in the face to kind of like snap out of it or whatever. And he wasn't at all, you know, it wasn't creepy or anything. He was just, it was really funny. And that's part, I don't know. I enjoy when people are characters and stuff. And, but I think as far as, yeah, I think it's just, it's taken time or whatever to change the standard of like what's acceptable to comment on my body or anything. He just,
right,
you know, pretended he fell in love with me, which is not, you know, can you blame him?
No. So I want to ask one thing, not about that women's songwriter group necessarily, but just about the musician friends you've made over the years. So I'm sure you've probably had the situation, and other people have too, where, you know, you're in a group of songwriters and you're all doing about the same level of business or success,
yeah,
or whatever. And then somebody out of that group kind of lifts up. I think it may be happening to you now. And I just wonder what it feels like for the other people there, and how, if you see somebody who's a friend of yours and a colleague or a peer, who all of a sudden they're sort of getting the spotlight on them, and it maybe hasn't happened for the rest of the group yet, how people deal with that, kind of what the dynamic is like.
Yeah, I think, I mean, like, for example, with Margo Price, when she played Saturday Night Live right after the release of the Midwest Farmer's Daughter, we had a big party and went to the Basement East and watched it on the big screen with everybody, you know. And that was just such a wild thing to watch one of your friends explode like that, you know, to that level so quickly. It was awesome. But yeah, you know, I think it's this human nature to have feelings of fear or like I'm not good enough or jealousy at different times. What I think is cool about our girlfriend group down here is that it's kind of like we all, for the most part at least, it's like we made the conscious decision to support and rally around each other, because, you know, I think especially with this stuff, the success of one means, you know, it leads us to everybody else. And the just example of I mean, I've talked about this a lot, but just how different friends, when they have experienced success over the last few years, like, you know, have like Margot's invited me to come do stuff with her, which led to me getting a little bit more attention, like during Americana Fest a couple years ago, and kind of helped spread the word about my music. And I think that it's the attitude. It's kind of like we just focus on, I don't know, for me, I like to try to choose, like, of course I have fear hit me sometimes, or like in a lull, you know. It's really hard, especially with social media. It's like, oh shit, I'm not doing anything right now. Well, it's been a long winter, you know what I mean? And look at this person, they're just getting to do all the cool festivals and blah, but it's like, but yeah, it kind of goes back to just, what am I doing in this moment right now? I'm in my house with air conditioning. I get to play music for a living now. It's like, you know, it's kind of just, it always passes. Any fear or whatever always passes. It's very temporary. And I think it's kind of cool to practice training my brain to look to the positive stuff.
Well, that's a good way to sum it up. When we come back, Erin Ray talks about a court case involving her family that still echoes through her life and her music. Plus, she performs a special song for us. That's still to come on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
You have a voice, but what if you felt like it wasn't being heard?
And I pointed from like my head to my toes and I said, does this look like consent to you?
WFAE's new investigative podcast, She Says, is available now. Listen to the first episode on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and on WFAE.org/She Says.
Support for She Says is provided by Contemplative Rebellion.
I want to take just a second to shine some light on a Southbound listener, Ben Swanson, who you can find at Cardboard Gerald on Twitter. Ben listened to our last episode featuring NBA legend Bobby Jones, and he had this comment. I thought the conversation about being a professional athlete and manual labor was really interesting. I had never thought of it that way. Thanks for the comment, Ben. That was something that struck me, too. These jobs that a lot of us think of as glamorous and fun can be a grind on the inside. As I used to say about the great baseball player Hank Aaron, it takes a lot of effort to make something look effortless. We want to feature other comments from listeners on future episodes, so let us hear from you. Tweet at me, at Tommy Tomlinson, or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks to all of you who listen. Now, back to our conversation with Aaron Ray. I want to talk a little bit about this record you made and your music in general. I've seen a lot of people, you know, obviously you speak with sort of a Southern accent. It's not like a super twangy, but it's clear, you know, you're from the South. I don't hear that as much in your singing voice. And I've seen lots of people compare it to, you know, I think Karen Carpenter, I heard some. I hear Amy Mann in there a little bit for me. But I guess I wonder, I want to talk about the lyrics separately, but I wonder just sort of musically if you hear something Southern in the music you make.
I think in the songwriting, maybe it comes across a little bit more. Maybe with the last record, there was like the harmonies with a couple different gals on the last record, mm-hmm. and the pedal steel and all that.
Right.
But I think also what's cool is like, recently been getting to know a lot of different kinds of music from the South, and that's not all like country music.
Right. But, so what kind of stuff are you listening to?
I mean, all kinds of stuff from like, you know, hip hop, and there's a guy named Charlie Crockett that I recently discovered, and he's kind of like a crossover, but like him and Kelsey Walden both, it's kind of like they pull together these influences of funk and soul, like Bill Withers, with country music, and it kind of it's just really cool how it ties it all together in a way. And it, I don't know, I just like the idea of like Southern music encompassing a lot more than just like country music with like a twang, you know. It's like,
sure,
it can kind of be like, I don't know, I guess with this record specifically on songs like Junebug and Grand Scheme, I feel like those are Southern to me, just in the way that, in the feeling that I'm trying to express, is like a very like humid summer, like sunset kind of energy, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. I think some of the songwriting, like, I know you say you want to talk about that separately.
Well, the lyrics,
I think that's where it shows up.
I saw, you know, and the one that struck me the most was Wild Blue Wind. And I think the first three words of the song are "Ain't No Telling." And then like two lines later, you're talking about how the guy that you're singing about never does call his mama and dem. You know, which as we know in the South, mama and dem's one word. And so I always, you know, listen for those little sort of sayings and phrases and all that sort of put somebody in a place. And those definitely put me there. And I just, you know, I hear that, or I feel that in the lyrics really strongly, but I like the idea of bringing in the other stuff too, and the music, and making it, I guess maybe kind of helping redefine a little bit about what counts as Southern music, you know?
Yeah. Thanks so much for listening to it.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about this thing with your aunt back in the 80s.
Yes.
It feels like sort of a, maybe kind of a signature moment in your life. Can you just describe what happened to her in court in Alabama?
Yeah. So this was in 1996. So I've got a cousin that's 4 months older than me. My mom's sister and my mom are pregnant around the same time. And there's some really cute pictures of them on the porch and stuff. but this is in Birmingham, Alabama. And anyway, when my cousin was about three, her parents divorced because my aunt is gay. And it was all good for a little bit there, but her dad remarried, and stepmom decided they wanted custody. And basically, they did a custody battle in court and all of that. So basically, the Alabama court system ruled my aunt unfit to be a mother because she was gay, that the child seemed well-adjusted and well taken care of, but because most of the people in the state of Alabama don't agree with a homosexual lifestyle, that's why they decided to rule against it. So it went all the way up to the Alabama State Supreme Court and lasted for a couple of years. So this is when we were six to about eight or nine, and basically what they ruled was that my cousin she could only be at her mom's house every other weekend until she was not a minor anymore, and her stepmom would not be allowed to see her. She would have to leave the house every other weekend in order for her to go over there. So, and they also, for some reason, she was never allowed to wake up at her house on Christmas. They always did it at his house. Just so, it was just very, very traumatizing. And and then in the third grade, she was in public school and my aunt was going to see her a couple times a week to have lunch with her. And I guess her stepmom found out and pulled her out of school and started homeschooling her. So it was just really, really, really painful to witness that we were, that's the closest part of my family, or the part of my family that I'm closest to, my extended family.
Right.
It just, to see how it affected everybody, I think I kind of internalized a lot of that. And just because there was so much discussion about it in our household too, you know? So I kind of, even though we were my parents were super loving and, you know, liberal and forward thinking, and a lot of our family friends and everybody were gay, like, I still internalized this fear. And that's kind of where the song Bad Mind comes from. That is where it comes from.
Right. Well, I want to talk about that because I know I can sense that there's obviously a lot of, on this record all the way through, of sort of struggling with identity and struggling with sexuality more clearly in some of the songs. And it sounds like from interviews I've read that that's something that you've been trying to process over the years. Did that, of those events, you know, back 20 years ago, as you were trying to sort through who you were, did that sort of color that in any way? Or did it keep you from, I don't know what the right word is, exploring more, telling your parents, any of those things?
Well, I think, I just, around, it's like sixth grade, I started getting crushes on friends of mine. And I was so just hyper aware of how I was feeling and did not want to be gay. I did not want to be different. And I mean, we were, you know, it's still weird. Even with loving family, we're still living in the South and whatever, middle school and all that stuff. A lot of, most kids went to Christian church. And we kind of went to like our weird, we were like the weird family that went to New Age, New Agey churches. But yeah, I think it kind of just I've tried basically from sixth grade on, I would like have these, I would just be racked with anxiety about it. And I would just think like, I don't want to be gay. I don't want to be gay. And I would like not, I would have like trouble falling asleep sometimes thinking about it. And it wasn't even, it like, I didn't even want to talk. I told my mom like mostly everything that I thought probably ever, but I really didn't want to tell her about this because, and if I brought it up to her, that would make it true for me. And I didn't, so it was just like a lot of like repression and aversion to that, you know? So yeah, I guess it did color it, you know, and I had a crush on a friend of mine in high school, and I basically just quit hanging out with her for like a year, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And you said you had anxiety over this for a long time. Like, when did it finally sort of get better for you, and was there any particular thing that made it get better?
I think just, I didn't really know what anxiety was. I thought that I just was like, that it was all justified. All my thought, you know, repetitive thought processes around it were like normal or, you know, I don't know, like I needed to think about it all. But a few years ago, someone was like, oh, honey, that's anxiety. You know, like you're worried about all these things all the time. Like that's what that is. And
so I guess, you know,
so starting to have the awareness around that kind of helped shift it.
Right. And you know that, I guess that Jason Isbell song, Anxiety, did you know that song?
I don't know that song.
I think it's on his latest album. It's okay. Basically a song about anxiety and how it screws with you. And how you basically describe the lyrics kind of on that song. You should go listen to that.
I will.
So yeah, I want to go back to something you said. You know, you talked about kind of having these feelings and trying to sort them out and being in the South. Did you ever wonder or wish that, you know, during that time when things were harder, that you had grown up somewhere else where maybe you would fit in better or that sort of thing?
I don't even think I had like the scope like of awareness of, you know, that it might be different elsewhere, or, you know, it was such an internal problem that I was having. It wasn't even, and I kind of discovered that the more and more that I talked to people, once I did start talking about it, it's just like nobody cares in my friend group. They're like, love whoever you want, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. But it just consumed me, basically. And it wasn't really about outside circumstances as much, you know, like as my own little brain.
Right. And I know that your group of friends is welcoming. I assume that, you know, your kind of larger circle in Nashville is probably welcoming too, but obviously there are big spots in the South that aren't as welcoming. By the way, I want to go back to something real quick. Do you have any idea that case involving your aunt, was Roy Moore involved in that in any way?
I looked that up, and he was not the district. He was in a different district at that time, but there was a similar case in Alabama around the same time that I think he was part of. I'm not. You might want to fact check me on
that just felt like something he would be a part of somehow.
Yeah, there's definitely, yeah.
So
he fits in well.
Yeah. So back to the original question I was asking before I sidetracked myself there. Do you feel any, you know, anger toward the South, or feel like, boy, this is a place I might want to get out of somehow or someday because of the way, you know, because of that, I think, correct feeling that parts of this region that we love in other ways are less tolerant than other places?
Well, it's a funny thing. I don't know that I would want to move out. I think I might at some point. But, you know, I think the joy of being a musician is getting to be in so many different places and see how different things, different cultures, and even in different cultures in the United States, kind of, you know, how things feel, the different vibe of places, getting to experience that in short spurts and meet people from all over. and with the internet, you know, there's so many resources, so that's cool. And Nashville itself is a pretty big city, or not big city, but like there's an influx of all different kinds of people, which is cool. And the thing is it'd probably be good for me to try some other places. I think I'm very drawn to tradition or a sense of tradition, I guess, like a sense of, I just feel so connected to the South, and there's so much of it that I romanticize, and I just think it's so beautiful down here. And I also feel, one of the reasons that it felt cool to me to release this record with Single Lock is that they're an Alabama-based label, and it was kind of like, I'm releasing this record that talks about this issue that began in Alabama, you know? Not that that's the only song on the record, but you know what I'm saying. So it kind of feels like full circle in a way, and I also do feel like a bit of a responsibility to kind of just help move things forward right where we are, you know?
Right. When you're away from home and you're out of the South, what do you miss?
What do I miss? I miss the accents and I moved out to the country recently up north of town, and it's just so green. I feel like Nashville reminds me of like the vegetation and everything kind of reminds me of like a rainforest vibe when it really gets going in the summer. It's like there's some like Shelby Bottoms Park is a wetlands technically, but like everything is just so lush and green and rolling hills and all of that. And I love Southern writers, you know, like Rick Bragg is one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Fortunately, I guess with the internet, the only things that I have to actually miss are like my family and just being in the summertime and being in that heat. I love that.
Oh, you do love it, because a lot of people, that's the reason they don't want to be here, you know?
Yeah. I love that feeling, you know, when you walk out here in our high-powered, air-conditioning, you know, rooms and stuff, you walk outside and you get hit with that, like, blanket of, like, humidity, and I love that. I love it so much.
You're in the minority there, but I know what you're saying. So I know this record has just been out a couple of weeks, but I wonder if you have heard from people who these songs have landed on, in you know, way where they heard themselves in the things we were singing about.
Yeah, people have been incredibly sweet and really nice about like sending me a message to let me know how something has made them feel, and or different friends who don't feel as free to talk about sexuality stuff. That's been one thing that's come up a lot, is like, I relate a lot to this song, you know, and like, I don't feel like I'm in a place to be able to give those feelings a voice, you know, just for whatever reason. And, or like, I experienced that growing up, that anxiety growing up in Church of Christ or whatever it is, you know. So that's been really meaningful to me to hear that.
And, you know, I know part of the reason people write songs are to kind of work through their own issues, kind of figure out the sort of their feelings. And it sounds like you were doing some of that on this record. Did it work? Did you feel better? Was it cathartic for you to do all this?
It has been. Yeah, and it kind of, I was talking to Dan Nobler, who's one of the guys that produced it. He was one of the guys that helped produce the record, and he was kind of like, yeah, it sounds like you made a guidebook for yourself, because we were listening back to the, like, Putting on Airs. That song is very much just calling myself out for some patterns of behavior and that I wanted to change, and just people-pleasing and in relationships. And, you know, it was like I had a moment of clarity, you know, and was able to write that song down, and then I was like, okay, like, listening back when we were doing the mixes and stuff, I was still kind of struggling with some of that stuff. And it just reminded me that the path that I'm trying to proceed on, you know, and kind of was like, no, you know better, you know, like you got to keep moving forward into the, it's even though it's like scary, into the uncertainty or whatever, and kind of try to just not do these same old things, you know. There's still obviously so much more to learn, as always, but I'll be able to think a lot less of myself on the next record. Start writing stories about other people, I hope.
I want to ask one last thing. You know, we talked at the very beginning about, you know, as a little kid, your mom and dad playing, you singing with them around the house. Is there anything on this record or maybe some other song you've done that sort of rings that bell, that reminds you of those moments or those times, whether it's a little piece of music or a turn of phrase or something?
You mean like one of my songs or just in general?
Yeah, something in one of your songs. I don't know if there's anything. I guess what I'm asking is there anything in the music you're making now that's evocative of those times back then?
I think so. I think Wild Blue Wind reminds that the way that I wrote that song is reminds me of all the songs I grew up hearing my dad play. I think that's probably the main one. But I feel like my phrasing is very much comes from my dad, and how it's just kind of like a lot of the phrases in the songs are kind of conversational. That kind of comes from him. My voice is, you know, just comes from loving my mom's voice so much. It's kind of a combination of the both of them. Mm-hmm. So it does help me to feel connected to them, just to make music in general.
Good, good. Erin, if you wouldn't mind, would you like to play us out with a song?
Sure. I was thinking I'll play, this is a song my dad wrote. I'm going to play it. It's called Satellite Dish.
I got a satellite dish with 100 channels, pay-per-view with a view of the dog food factory. It don't take much to please me. 2 more weeks I'll turn 47. Saved 13, so I'm going to heaven. It don't ease me. No one comes to see me. I live alone with my TV on. Drink my beer. It seems to calm my fears. Always worked real hard. Never got real far. Asking why, and try to be satisfied with a satellite dish and 100 channels, pay-per-view with the view of the dog food factory. It don't take much to please me. 2 more weeks I'll turn 47. Saved 13, so I'm going to heaven. It don't ease me. No one comes to see me. My wife's long gone. Don't know what went wrong, but the kids all know. Daddy's gotta see his show. Could have been someone. Now I work for his son, and he don't care if I ain't all there. I got a satellite dish and 100 channels, pay-per-view with a view of the dog food factory. Don't take much to please me. 2 more weeks I'll turn 47. Saved 13, so I'm going to heaven. It don't ease me. No one comes to see me. No one comes to see me.
I I believe there's more than one good songwriter in your family.
I think I'm not the first.
Not the first. Aaron Ray, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
I want to tell you about the moment right there at the end of our conversation when Aaron Ray played that song for us. She was in a little studio at the NPR station in Nashville, playing just for the engineer and the one or two other people who happened to be around. I was listening on headphones in Charlotte with Nick Delacanal, who produces Southbound. At the moment she was playing and singing, there were only four or five of us in the whole world who were getting to hear that live. When she was done, we got back on the mics, we said goodbye, and then Nick and I walked out into the hall. We looked at each other and said the same thing. Wow. There are few things in the universe more powerful than a guitar and a voice and the poetry of a good song. I hope Aaron Ray's song moved you the way that it moved us. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org with show notes and other extras for every episode. Between episodes, look for the Southbound Radio Hour, the playlist of music based on the most recent guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.